all the significant atheist rebuttals in one set. So you'll be seeing that on our next set of television episodes. Hey, there are more than 17 rebuttals, but these are the ones we thought were the most significant rebuttals that people are dealing with today. And so we go through these different questions and issues raised by non-theists to why maybe we don't need to consider the God of the Bible. And so you can catch these episodes. And by the way, you don't have to get up at 4:30 in the morning. We archive all of our television shows on our website. You can go to our website and you'll see this whole lot being discussed. Now, this is one of my favorite ones, but anyways. And then a third announcement I want to give. This got published just a couple of days ago. It's the statement from the American Association for the Advancement of Science on the Kansas State School Board decision. And it's only like three paragraphs long. But what was significant to me is they really focused in on the Kansas State Board's decision to delete cosmology as a requirement rather than biological evolution. You know, the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences, if you're not familiar, is a group of, it's an organization for scientists all over America, but it's heavily dominated by biologists. You know, it's about 80-90% of their membership comes from the biological sciences. And yet when they published this statement in response to Kansas, I found it interesting that they really focused on cosmology. I'll just read you a couple of excerpts from it. They talk about the decision to remove references to evolution and cosmology from its state education requirements, thereby making central principles for the scientific understanding of the universe and its history optional subjects for science education. Discourages teachers from using the best available professional knowledge about the nature and history of the universe. Concepts and evidence inextricably linked to our understanding of the nature and history of the universe are fundamental to the basic education of all Americans. So the fact that they really didn't mention biological evolution but focused on the cosmology aspects I thought were interesting. And again, if you aren't aware of the background, what happened in Kansas is that young earth creationists there said, we're going to remove as a requirement anything that would be offensive to our interpretation. And yes, the AAAS was astute in picking out that what was of greatest concern to those believers was not so much biological evolution as it was the fact that we have this universe that's traceable back to a beginning billions of years ago. So anyway, that's posted on the AAAS website if you want to go to it. We can get you copies as well. Okay. These six discoveries are just the highlights. As some of you have been here before will realize, what our scientific team at Reasons to Believe does is one of our occupations is go through the scientific literature and pull those papers that are revealing more evidences for the God of the Bible and the reliability of the Bible, and we're currently counting about 600 such discoveries per year. So these six that I've chosen just from the last 2 weeks are simply the highlights of what's out there. And before I go through them, let me just list the titles for these six that we'll discuss, because, you know, if hands start coming up and people start coming up here, you might say, Hugh, can you skip that one and focus on those two instead? And I'm open to doing that. But one of the more outstanding discoveries is the fact that they have found vertebrates right in the Cambrian rock structures. And it's the first definitive evidence of vertebrate fossils going back right to the Cambrian explosion. Number two is a very interesting article in Nature on quantum tunneling in proteins and how this quantum tunneling not only enhances the efficiency of these protein molecules, it greatly enhances the survivability of the species. And it kind of ties into what we've been saying, how it's necessary to fine-tune the Heisenberg uncertainty principle if you want life to possibly exist in our universe. It's a design evidence. This week, a whole bunch of extrasolar planets were discovered. the list has gone from 20 to 29 such planets in just 1 week. So I want to tell you a little bit about what that's all about and how scientists are reacting to it, how we should interpret it. And then there's another Martian meteorite that they have found. It was discovered in the Nile Delta. But they're discovering that these Martian meteorites are very rapidly contaminated by Earth terrestrial amino acids. And, you know, this week is all the news is Mars. In fact, Mars made the cover of Newsweek magazine this week. Too bad the satellite isn't reporting back to Earth. But what this discovery in the Nile Delta is pointing out to us is that we have to be very careful about trying to bring back rock samples from Mars because of the fact that there is this potential for very rapid and efficient contamination. The next one is an article on global warming, biodiversity, and a discovery that climatic changes, subtle climatic changes, have a dramatic impact on the top fauna, the top predators and the top herbivores, and also explains why we see such great biodiversity on the planet. And then finally, there's a review paper that got published in Nature this past week, which addresses the challenge of these DNA sequences. I mean, just in the last 2 years, biochemists have been able to sequence the complete genome for many different species. But how this is providing new challenges to the theories of biological evolution. And so I'll try to talk to you a little bit about what those challenges are. Okay, let me go back to the beginning. This is the article that was published in Nature. It's called Lower Cambrian Vertebrates from South China. And what's been happening in the past 3 years is that they have found in China, in South China, a place called Qingjiang, they have found a fossil outcropping that's rather similar to the one in Canada that exposes the Cambrian explosion. I mean, until 3 years ago, the only evidence we had of the Cambrian explosion was this mountain in a national park in British Columbia. Matter of fact, what amazes me is you can go to a place called Emerald Lake. Millions of tourists stream through there every year, and a mile away from the chateau is this Burgess Shale outcropping, and nobody visits it. It's just sitting there. But my friends in Canada say, well, there's a good reason why we haven't put any signs there. We didn't want these millions of tourists going up there and taking away the evidence. On the other hand, it's virtually straight up to get to the Burgess Shale, so that may be a sufficient detriment in itself. But now they found a second one. And by comparing the Chinese data with the Canadian data, about 2.5 years ago, paleontologists concluded that the Cambrian explosion was much more rapid than what was in our textbooks. You know, when I took biology, what you saw in the textbooks was that this Cambrian event took place over 50 million years. By comparing the Chinese data with the Canadian data, the conclusion was it's less than 5 million years. So it really is an explosive event. You say, well, what exploded? Okay, the Cambrian explosion, and by the way, I think the data really supports something even briefer than 5 to 10 million years, because what I see in all these articles is they give you a date for the Cambrian event that's accurate to three figures, 543 million years ago. And something that does go on in paleontology is what I call stretching the error bars as far as they will go. What the data really tells us is that all of the events of the Cambrian explosion occurred in a window of time that's between 0 and 10 million years, or 0 and 5 million years, depending which papers you read. But what you see as a conclusion is that means that this took place over 5 to 10 million years, rather than something less than 5 to 10 million years. It could have been 0. But just like in the days before this discovery, you had paleontologists always trying to stretch the error bar as far as it will go. If it's 0 to 50 million, we'll say it's 50 million. If it's 0 to 10 million, we'll say it's 10 million. If it's 0 to 5 million, we'll say it's 5 million. When in fact, what it's saying is it could be as brief as 0 or as long as 5 million. All right. 543 million years ago, we had a major transition in the fossil record. Before that time, what you see in the fossil record are unicellular life forms, or life forms that are strings of cells existing in a long filament. And so before the Cambrian explosion, you do not see plants and animals with structure. I mean, differentiated organs and appendages. That happened at the Cambrian explosion. But the other thing that's interesting is that almost all of it happened at the Cambrian explosion. All of the phyla that we see on planet Earth today appeared at the Cambrian event. So 543 million years ago, you've got this sudden appearance of 100 new phyla of life. Today we have on planet Earth 30 phyla. So 70 have disappeared in the last half billion years, 30 remain. And of those 30, all of them were present at the Cambrian explosion. Now, that's as a result of this paper. Before this paper was published, there was some dispute about the chordate phyla. Who are the chordates? Those are all the animals with backbones, or vertebrates. We call them vertebrates. So all of us here are part of the chordate phylum, which we share with all birds, all mammals, all reptiles, all amphibians, all fish. Now, we're all part of the chordate phylum. So you can understand, when biologists speak about phyla, they're speaking about very broad categories of life. Now, in the Burgess Shale, the Canadian exposure, there were two fossil finds that were identified as chordates. But they were identified as primitive chordates because they didn't have a lot of soft tissue evidence. They didn't have evidence for the muscle structure. They really didn't have vertebrate bones. But they saw things like gills and lungs that made them feel that these were part of the chordate phylum. What's new out of China is they have found two fossils. These are fossils of fish in which they see evidence for fins, and the strongest evidence is they see this wishbone-type muscular structure on the back of the creature. In other words, they can see this cross band of muscles that is a factor for all chordates. Along our back, we have these muscles that run along the ribs, that enable the backbone to be connected to the muscle structure of the rest of the body. And so with that finding coming out of China this past week, they say there's no question that we have relatively advanced chordates all the way back to the Cambrian explosion. What they had before coming out of Canada was, well, maybe we see some eel-like structures. And these were creatures that were like lamprey eels, but they had no jaws. They had no teeth. These creatures are different. We can see the muscular structure of chordates that we see today. Now, so this establishes that it's not just 29 of the 30 phyla on planet Earth that were present at the Cambrian event, but indeed all 30. And in terms of the most advanced phylum, namely the chordates, we see relatively advanced examples right back to the Cambrian event itself. You say, well, what's the bottom line in terms of science and theology? The bottom line is that we have a very rapid appearance of chordates in a fairly advanced stage taking place at the Cambrian event, and very little happening thereafter in terms of development of major structural changes. Nothing happens after that event 543 million years ago, and even for the most advanced of the phylum, it happens very rapidly. Because this paper establishes we know that we don't have chordates much previous to the Cambrian event 543 million years ago. They take the pains to refute a claim that maybe they had found something 100 million years or 50 million years previous to the Cambrian event. but they established that that's not the case. It was bad data analysis, and indeed nothing happens until the Cameron event. And so the challenge for those who are trying to say that all this happened without God being involved is how can you get something as advanced as chordates coming from unicellular life or life with cells all in a nice long line in such an incredibly rapid period of time? And, you know, what I'm suggesting is there's really no naturalistic explanation for how you can get chordates that fast. For that matter, there's no naturalistic explanation for how you get all 100 of these new phyla that show up at the Cameron event. But this is really generating quite an electrifying response amongst paleontologists around the world. Review papers are coming out about it as well. Okay. Right next to it was this paper titled Natural Engineering Principles of Electron Tunneling and Biological Oxidation Reduction Reactions. Sounds like a very intriguing title, right? And it's dealing with a particular redox reaction within proteins. And the first thing that these four different researchers discover is that the old way that we thought these proteins work, which was moving electrons through the OH molecule, really isn't all that efficient. And that what we have within these proteins that they're studying is that they have reactants coming between 0 and 14 angstroms within one another. It's a very tiny distance measure, small enough that they said we can expect quantum tunneling to be a factor in the movement of these electrons. And they discover that indeed this quantum tunneling is going on, and the rate of electron transfer is far greater than what we would get through what was presumed to be the means of moving these electrons before. You say, why did it take so long for them to discover this? Well, keep in mind it's only been the last couple of years that they've been able to use X-ray electron scanning microscopes to map these molecules down to the atomic level. And so in the past, they were basically guessing how the electrons are moved, and they said this seems like an efficient chemical way to move it through the OH molecule. But as these people point out with the new maps, they have these molecules. No, what we got going on here is quantum tunneling, which allows an order of magnitude greater efficiency for electron transfer, which means the protein can do its job more efficiently and at a more rapid pace than what we thought before. But there's a byproduct to this research that I think is really stunning, and that is that this quantum tunneling mechanism for electron transfer is an order of magnitude more immune to mutations in that protein molecule, which means that protein molecules that take advantage of quantum tunneling are really in a position to survive the onslaught of mutations in these molecules much better than molecules that don't take advantage of quantum tunneling. And hey, if you kind of deduce what was going to happen here, what we really discover is that the survivability of life here on planet Earth depends on these protein molecules being designed to take advantage of quantum tunneling. And so, you know, in terms of how long species can remain on the Earth before they go extinct through mutations, this quantum tunneling stretches their period of survivability. And I would look at this as another piece of evidence that life has been designed. As these people point out, this is really the best way to do it if you're dealing with an environment where mutations are likely. And as I've pointed out before, mutations must happen. Without radiation, life is impossible. But because of radiation, mutations must happen. What we see is that these molecules are optimally designed to handle both the radiation and the mutations and still function. The other thing that comes out of all of this is that the survivability of the organism and the efficiency of this electron transfer both are dependent on carefully fine-tuning the degree of uncertainty and the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. You know, what we have as the cornerstone of quantum mechanics is that the human observer cannot simultaneously measure accurately both the position and the momentum of the quantum entity, the particle, we have to choose which one we're going to carefully measure. And if we measure, say, the position or, say, the energy or the momentum of the quantum particle accurately, we discover we're not able to discern its position to any greater accuracy than plus or minus 2,000 feet. So when we talk about uncertainty in quantum mechanics, we really do mean uncertainty. The uncertainty is enormous. I mean, you just think of this quantum entity being, say, 10 to the minus 15 centimeters across, and yet we can't determine its position to any better than plus or minus 2,000 feet. So that's enormous uncertainty. But if you make the uncertainty any greater or any lesser, then these protein molecules don't work as well as they need to work in order for organisms to survive long enough so that people like us would be possible on a planet. So this is brand new. I think it's one of the more exciting new evidences we have for design. It's a wonderful way of combining the physics and the biology to expose design that hasn't been seen until now. Okay, extrasolar planets. This made the news. A week ago, we were aware of 20 planets outside of our solar system. And what you saw on the network news television programs is a study that came out of Berkeley that boosted that from 20 to 28. And they didn't say anything about number 29, which, in my perspective, may be even more exciting than the 8 new ones that they found. But New York Times made this a big play. And the data is this. They investigated 530 stars that are close to us. And yeah, they've got to be close or you're not going to be able to detect these planets easily. And about 5% of the stars that they investigated wound up having planets. That's where they got the 8 planets from. So, and by the way, that doesn't mean that 5% of all the stars in our galaxy have planets, because it's the stars that are near us, and then they're selecting it. They're looking at stars that are close to us and stars that are like the sun. So solar-like nearby stars. Well, when I was taught astrophysics in my graduate school days 30 years ago, we were taught back then that the stars with the greatest likelihood for planets were solar-type stars that are close to our star. Once you get further away, you're dealing with metal abundances for the stars that are a lot less. Once you get away from the mass of the sun, again, the probability really drops. The bottom line is what this data shows us, unlike the extreme optimism of what you saw in the New York Times and the television network news, is we're really looking at maybe 1% of all the stars having planets rather than 5 to 10%. So I would agree that in our galaxy we may have a few billion planets, assuming that the stars that have planets have more than one, it could be that high. But hey, that's only 9 zeros after the 1. You know, if you've been reading our literature, the probability of finding a planet with the capacity to support life, any given planet, just take a random planet, the probability of any random planet in our universe will have the capacity to support life is less than 1 chance in 10 to the 133. So the fact that there is a billion planets in our galaxy, that only takes 9 zeros away from the probability. The fact that there is a trillion galaxies in our universe, that only takes away another 12 zeros. Let's see, that's 33 minus 21. That still leaves you with less than 1 chance in 10 to the 111 that you're going to find a planet with the capacity to support life. And actually, if you read the fine print of the news report, New York Times brought this out, network TV news stations, is they did admit that all the planets they have found have highly eccentric orbits. What I mean by that is, and you know, these are all Jupiter-type planets, planets that are the mass of Jupiter up to about 8 times the mass of Jupiter. So these are supergiant planets, obviously, because those are the only ones they can really detect with this technology, are the really big ones. But what's different about Jupiter and Saturn, the gas giants in our solar system, is that they have circular orbits. In other words, as Jupiter is going around the sun, that part of its orbit where it's closest to the sun is about the same as that orbit where it's farthest from the sun. It's roughly a circle. A circle to within about 1% precision. But when we look at these other planets that we're discovering around these extrasolar stars, we discover that none of them have circular orbits. All of their orbits are highly elliptical, which means they orbit like this. They come in close, then they go far away. For example, they were able to measure the eccentricity of these planets, and like this one, at its closest approach, it's 36 million miles from its star. At its farthest approach, it's 214 million miles from its star. So that's an extremely eccentric orbit. Now, what you heard on the network news is that the discovery of all these extrasolar planets means that there are billions of planets running around our galaxy and in the universe, and that many of these may be sites for harboring life. While they have a highly eccentric orbit, we immediately know they cannot possibly be a site for a life support planet. It is true that in addition to the supergiant planet, there may be smaller planets. But if you've got a supergiant planet with a highly eccentric orbit, the gravitational pull from that supergiant planet is guaranteed to disturb or perturb the life support planet from the orbit it needs to sustain life. You know, just to give you an example, here on planet Earth, we're 93 million miles away from the sun. But if you were to disturb the distance of planet Earth from the sun by a half million miles, make it an average of 94 million miles or 92 million miles, then advanced life would no longer be sustainable on a planet. Make it a million miles, primitive life would no longer be sustainable on our planet. All we got to do is disturb it by about 1%, and life becomes impossible on planet Earth. And as it is, if Jupiter had any more of an eccentric orbit than what we observe, instead of an eccentricity of 1%, an eccentricity of 2%, then planet Earth would be disturbed sufficiently that life wouldn't be possible on our planet. And the case of all these extrasolar planets, all 28 of them have orbits that are sufficiently eccentric to guarantee that there is no life support planets around them. Yes, at the back. Yeah, I'm not quite catching you. Can you come to the mic so I can hear you? Yeah. Yes. Right. Right. It's a Doppler shift detection method. Correct.
And it would probably kick out more eccentric orbits because the pull on the sun would be strong.
Oh, yeah, they can get down to eccentricities of 1% without any trouble. Of the 28 planets that they have found, the one with the lowest eccentricity is at about a 3% level. But that 3% level is still enough that you're not going to have a life support planet in that system. Now, what generated some enthusiasm, maybe I need to back up here and just explain how they're detecting these planets, because this is the question that was raised here. Okay, you've got planet Earth, all right? Then you've got the star, and you've got a planet orbiting about that star. If the planet is big, and say everything is in the line of sight, you got the Earth, you got the star, you got the planet, all in the line of sight. If the planet is massive enough, when it's on this side between the star and the planet, it's going to gravitationally pull the star towards you. And when it's on the other side, it's going to pull it away. And so what astronomers do is they measure the spectral lines of the star. And as it gets blue shifted, that tells us that the planet is pulling the star towards us. As it is red shifted, it's pulling the star away from us. Now, that explains why they're picking off really big planets. The bigger the planet, the easier it is to see this pushing back and forth of the star. It's also easier if it's in the line of sight. I mean, if the planet's orbiting like this, then it's not really going to pull it back and forth in the line of sight, which is why all the planetary masses that they have discovered are simply lower limits. One piece of speculation was, well, gee, maybe these are just stars. They're not planets at all. What you've got are stars that are orbiting like this, and they may be 50 times the mass of Jupiter, but because they're orbiting perpendicular to our line of sight, we're underestimating the mass of these planets. But I think one thing that really told us that at least some of them must be real planets is, again, it was about 2-3 weeks ago that the Keck telescope was able to image when the planet came in front of the star. They got enough resolution where they could see the disk of the star and a little black spot on the star showing that the planet actually did cut across directly in the line of sight. So in that case, they know that it's not just an object whose mass was greatly overestimated or underestimated, but it really was a planet. And hey, statistically, some of them would have to be planets. But still, even today, I would easily concede that maybe 30 to 40% of these 28 planets really aren't planets, they're brown dwarfs, or might even be red dwarfs, because we don't know the angle. Now, what I wanted to talk about is this paper. This is number 29 in the list, and it didn't make the New York Times, didn't make the evening news, nothing. And in fact, when I pulled this again out of Nature, and it didn't even make the front cover of Nature. I looked in the front, and it really didn't make even the news and views section of Nature. So this is really escaping attention. But what it is the discovery of a planet by a brand new technique. It's not using this redshift, blue shift. They're using gravitational lenses. And so it's using the theory of general relativity. And what's going on here is you've got a star in front of another star system. And it gravitationally lenses the system in such a way you can tell what's going on. If it's a nice lens, which means you've got a nice lineup of the distant star to the line of sight through a star in between is doing the gravitational lensing, then you can actually discern a little bit of the structure of the object behind. And they're able to use that method to say what we're seeing is a planet a little bit more massive than Jupiter, about 2.5 to 3 times the mass of Jupiter, orbiting a binary star system. And so that's planet number 29 on the list. But I think what's really exciting is it shows us that this technique of gravitational lensing has the potential to find even more planets than this technique developed in Berkeley by Marcy and Butler. Yes. No, this would be a star on a star. You know, if you got a galaxy as a gravitational lens, it would be effective for imaging another galaxy, but not a star. So it's got to be star upon star, or star upon planet, or planet upon star. That will work. This technique is not as good for measuring the eccentricity. They can measure the distance of the planet to the star. They can measure the mass of the planet, and that's about it. But I'll tell you where the method is very powerful. This planet that they were able to detect is, I got to work out the math. It's about 26,000 light years away. Now then, this method out of Berkeley, its limit is 200 light years. Once you get 200 light years away, it's not going to have sufficient sensitivity to find planets at all. But this gravitational lens method has the capacity to find planets not only in our galaxy, but even nearby galaxies like the Large Magellanic Cloud. So it'll be a powerful tool for exploring the density of planets in our entire galaxy, rather than those that are just really close to us. So that should be interesting. And by the way, what excitement it generated, it said, hey, the author said, this is the first time we found a planet orbiting a double star system. Bit of an overstatement. Of the 28, there's one of those where the planet is orbiting a double star system. So there are two that orbit a double star system. And again, what I was taught in graduate school is planets can only exist around bachelor stars. Because after all, if you get two stars in the system, they will gravitationally interact and destabilize the orbits. But thanks to these discoveries and also thanks to these new computer games where you can build your own solar system, we now know that's not true if the planet is really big. So it is possible for a planet, say the mass of Jupiter or a few times the mass of Jupiter, to have a stable orbit around a double star system if the two stars are close enough together. And in this case, they determined that the two stars are about 160 million miles apart. So they're relatively close together, just a little bit farther apart than the Earth is from our sun. And that the planet that's orbiting about these two stars is 700 million miles from the center of the two-star system. So a little bit more distant than Jupiter going around these two stars. And hey, I've played with these computer games and make the planet big enough and put the stars close enough together, you can get a stable orbit. The problem, then, though, is you're not going to get a stable orbit for a planet like Earth. The little planets, if you play these games, get destroyed very quickly. Now, again, when I say very quickly, I'm speaking on an astronomical time scale. In millions of years, we see that their orbit gets destabilized sufficiently that the planet gets sucked into one of the stars or gets kicked out of the star system. And, you know, my boys love this little game we have at home. You set it all up and throw a bunch of planets in. But what they like to do is set it up so that all the planets get destroyed as fast as possible. And I say, no, that's not the purpose of the game. You're supposed to try to set up a stable system here. But, gee, the instant you put in another star, you really do kiss all the small planets goodbye. They're gone in short order. But you can keep the big ones. But, yeah, the textbooks of 20, 30 years ago were saying you can't even have big ones. Now we know we have big ones. But again, some of the deception I heard on the evening news is now we know that it's not just bachelor stars. Multiple star systems can also have planets, and that means that the possibility of finding life elsewhere in our universe is much greater. Well, hey, if it's a double star system, there is no possibility of a planet like Earth having an orbit that's stable enough to remain in the life support zone. That's just not going to happen. Yeah, Jupiter, no problem. And by the way, the planet in this case, we know you asked the question, does it have an eccentric orbit? It's got to have an eccentric orbit if it's orbiting two stars. There's no way it's going to have a circular orbit. But that's the latest on, yeah.
When you're saying stable orbit, you don't mean eccentric. So we've got a binary star, and we've got a stable orbit about it, but it's not going to be...
It's not going to be circular. Now, it won't be circular, but it will be stable. The reason it's stable is the planet's big enough to take care of itself. It's not going to get beat up that much. By the way, if you wait long enough, many billions of years, you've got a fairly high probability that that planet will be destabilized. But we're only talking a billion years. Yeah, it should stick to its two stars. That won't be a problem. Okay. Now, let me move on to this. This one's called Amino Acids in the Martian Meteorite NACLA. Yeah, you've probably heard of NACLA. But, you know, all the fuss was on ALH84001, that thing they found in Antarctica, and how they said we have found the remains of life in this meteorite from Mars. And if you've been reading the back pages of the newspaper, page 54 and farther, you'll see little tiny disclaimers to the effect that, well, we really have to withdraw the claim. And one of the reasons for withdrawing the claim is that the amino acids they found in ALH84001 had the same relative abundances as the amino acids we see in Antarctic meltwater. And so that tells us that the bacteria in Antarctic meltwater contaminated ALH84001. Those amino acids are really not of Martian origin. They're of terrestrial origin. At least some of them are, but the ones that were pointing to life were of terrestrial origin. So that was just one of many reasons why the claim has now been withdrawn. But there was a big flap last August because they found this meteorite in the Nile Delta. And they said it too has amino acids. And so we also knew it was from Mars. And I said with these amino acids that we find in proteins, then maybe we got evidence for life in Martian soil. But what this paper by Daniel Glavin and Jeffrey Botta and his team points out, the amino acid ratios that we see in this Martian meteorite are identical to the ratio of amino acids we see in Nile Delta soil. And but unlike ALH84001, they knew that this meteorite had been recovered soon after it landed. And so the whole point of the paper is this establishes that terrestrial contamination happens very rapidly. This meteorite hadn't been on the face of the earth. In fact, I heard Jeffrey Botta give a paper on this at the Origin of Life conference in UCSD last July. And he says, if we're going to find evidence for life in these Martian meteorites, we better catch them before they hit the ground. So he says, as soon as they hit the ground, they get contaminated. And somebody said, well, there are bacteria in the air, too. So and we better catch them before they get through the atmosphere. But one of the things he has, which I think is interesting in light of what's been going on this week at JPL, is that missions to Mars to look for the remains of life on Mars and bring back samples to Earth for analysis, we better make sure that we take care not to expose those rocks to a terrestrial environment. And so Jeffrey Botta, for example, at his conference was saying, you know, you don't even want to let this stuff from Mars get exposed to the air. Because you could go to all this expense, and it's going to cost a lot of money to bring back these lunar rocks from the surface of Mars. But he says we need to really pay attention to make sure that stuff doesn't get contaminated. You know, the craft could contaminate it. The journey back home, there could be contamination. And once the laboratory scientists begin to work on it, there's a potential for contamination. He says the old idea that contamination wouldn't happen very quickly, we now know is not true. It happens very quickly. It happens very easily. And hey, as you've heard me say here before, we already know that the remains of Earth life are all over the solar system. So in that sense, the contamination's already happened. But, you know, yes, got a comment there? Yeah, even in the interior of the rock, you got significant rapid contamination. I mean, the team, if you read the paper here, I can make it available to you. They were utterly amazed at how rapidly and efficiently the contamination takes place. And so they're saying to JPL, guys, you better watch out. This stuff happens very rapidly, and you have the slightest accident, and you're going to have a contaminated sample. So, but, you know, again, bottom line is, in one sense, we know the contamination's already happened. Billions of tons of Earth-like material have already been transported to the surface of Mars. And so NASA may simply be bringing back the remains of Earth life from the surface of Mars. Same thing with the satellites of Jupiter. We already know the remains of Earth life are there. Yes? It's molecular contamination. That's right. Yeah, they can go through several feet of rock. It's not a big deal. And so that's a good point. We're talking molecules that are only like 20 to 40 atoms. So they're relatively small molecules. And if you've got water present, oxygen present, they're just going to move right in and invade everything. So, yeah, we're not talking bacteria getting into the rock. You know, that could happen, but that is a slow process. But these protein or these amino acids, they get through really easily. In spite of all that, they haven't found any sugars in any of this stuff. So there should be some sugar contamination, too, but as yet we haven't found any. But we do know that sugars are much less invasive than amino acids. It's going to be much more difficult for the sugars to get in. So but that right away should tell you that something's wrong. If life really was everywhere in our solar system or on the surface of Mars, we should be finding lots of sugars. Zero. Zero sugars from outer space. Okay, go ahead.
because God promises and will still fulfill all the purposes for which he made it. But you got a person who doesn't think he made it, it's all going to blow up in a few thousand years. It could blow up tomorrow anyway. You got to be careful.
To support life is quite another for life to originate there. I think a lot of the deception we're hearing out of NASA is, hey, if we find a site that's appropriate for life, that guarantees life will be there. Well, when you look at the origin of life experiments that are going on, we need to be a lot more skeptical. Simply finding conditions where the chemistry is possible doesn't mean it's going to happen. If that were true, we'd have to watch out with the soup that we put on our oven. That it'd be spontaneously producing life while we're putting it together. And to keep in mind, a soup that you put on the oven, that's a far more favorable environment for the origin of life than anything any of these researchers are looking at. And yet none of us worries about our bowl of soup spontaneously producing a new life form. At least I don't worry about that when I'm doing my cooking up my soup. But in terms, again, part of it is that we're looking at a far too an abbreviated list of characteristics that are necessary for life. What I hear coming from a lot of NASA scientists, if we can find a planet that's got liquid water on it, then we know life is there. And liquid water is only one requirement for life. There are many others. The list that we published now has 112 different characteristics on it that must be satisfied if even the most primitive life form is to be possible. And liquid water is only one of the 112 we have on the list. And so simply find, by the way, this is something I think needs to be exposed. Water is extremely abundant in our universe. You know, of all the molecules that exist in our universe, water is the second most abundant molecule. You know, you got hydrogen too. After that, it's the water molecule. And as an astronomer, I can tell you all the gas clouds we observe in our galaxy are loaded with water. Now, mind you, that water is usually frozen or gaseous. It is quite rare to find an environment with liquid water on it. But for example, this paper that got published about these eight new planets that they have found. And they said, well, that brings the list to 28. Of the 28, five of those planets are in the habitable zone. Okay, read the fine print. Because what it looks like is they're saying that means five of the 28 planets are sites for life. But you recognize how they define habitable zone. This is a planet whose surface temperature, if it had no atmosphere, would be between 32 degrees Fahrenheit and 212 degrees Fahrenheit. So that means that it would have a temperature where liquid water could possibly reside. Okay, 2 points. You're not going to get liquid water hanging around if you're at either of those extremes. If it's near boiling condition, you're going to get what's called a runaway boil off of the water. Matter of fact, what we realize here on planet Earth, if we were to disturb the energy flow coming to planet Earth from the sun by 1%, you either get all the water going towards ice and snow or all the water going towards a vapor state. So trying to find conditions where it stays liquid is much more confining than 32 to 212 degrees. Okay, second point is pressure is important. Not just enough that you get the right temperature, you have to get the right pressure. And I had a third point here, which I think I'm forgetting. Yes, atmosphere. Okay? These planets that they're finding, we all know have very heavy atmospheres. The flow of energy from the star through that atmosphere will dramatically alter the temperature at the surface of that planet. So yeah, it might have a temperature of 108 degrees, as they said about one of these stars, at the surface, but it's assuming it's got no atmosphere. We know it's got an atmosphere. Okay. The atmosphere does one of two things. If it's an atmosphere like Jupiter, what that means is very little solar energy gets through past the upper layers of the, of that atmosphere. Which means you're looking at very low temperatures by the time you get down to any surface. And incidentally, there are lots of astronomers who say, with respect to Jupiter and planets bigger than Jupiter, there may not be a surface as we would know it. We call them gas giants for a reason. We got good evidence to think that they're made up of gas-type molecules all the way down to the core itself. And so, the stuff will eventually freeze, of course. You'll have frozen methane and frozen ammonia at the bottom, maybe even frozen hydrogen. And hey, if you go close enough to the center, you might even get solid hydrogen. But this is hardly a surface environment where life could be sustainable. So, with those three caveats, we have the conclusion that none of these 28 would have a temperature suitable for liquid water to remain for a period of time. And again, if you got liquid water, that's only one requirement. I'm persuaded that there may indeed be liquid water on Europa, but I'm not at all persuaded that Europa is a place where we have any possibility of finding an environment where life could exist. So in terms of spending our tax dollars to look for bacteria in the European Ocean, we got to have a lot more than liquid water there before I think it'd be worthwhile spending that kind of money. By the way, I am in favor of going to Europa. I think Europa is a very fascinating satellite. But I think we need to go there to look for something besides bacteria. Yes. No, it's not quite true. I mean, this technique does have the capacity to find gas giants with low eccentricity orbits. It's more difficult to pick them up, but the technique should yield quite a few if they do indeed exist. And the answer is so far we haven't found any. And by the way, and I said one of them is 3%, only one has one as low as 3%. The averages are around 20 to 30%. So these are extremely eccentric. They're more eccentric than the orbits of Mercury and Pluto. You know, our solar system has two planets with non-circular orbits. Fortunately, they're both very small, and they're both far away from the Earth. But the rest of them, circular orbits. And we look at these extrasolar planets, none of them have circular orbits like we see in our solar system. Yeah, the majority of stars are in binary or multiple star systems. And so that means only a fraction of the stars would be bachelor and therefore with the capacity of a planet like Earth that wouldn't get disturbed. So yeah, in terms of all the binary stars, all the multiple stars, you can scratch them off the list. They might have planets, but they're not going to have planets like Earth. Oh, the fact that only two of the 29 are going around double star systems, that's not at all odd. The more stars you stick into the system and the farther apart you put the stars, the higher the probability it will lose its planets, even its big ones. So yeah, your best chance for finding these gas giants is around bachelor stars. However, there's a small possibility you can find them around binary stars. While the stars are close together, and the planet going about them is reasonably distant and big, it'll work. But that, again, puts you down in the minority, not the majority. Yes?
If you could summarize a little bit the radiometric gain. In other words, elements that should be on Earth near the very young age, what elements, radioactive elements, should be found here, and is there anything
okay. Wes is probably responding to a challenge coming from the young Earth creationist community. Maybe a lot of you aren't realizing, but they pulled together this team of their best scientists to try to find a way around the challenge of radiometric dates. I mean, if you believe radiometric dating, the Earth is billions of years old, the universe is billions of years old, so they've pulled together best people to see if they could find some way to refute radiometric dating. And I'm basically telling you, they should disband. There is no hope that they're going to be able to refute radiometric dating. And if it was really true that the universe was as young as they say and the Earth was as young as they say, as West points out, we should find short-lived radionuclides that don't come from some parent radiometric element. A good example would be plutonium and neptunium. We do not see any natural plutonium or neptunium on the face of the Earth, and we don't see any in the universe. I forget the half-life of plutonium, but I think it's like 3,400 to 4,000 years. And so if the Earth were, say, 6,000 years old, we should still see lots of plutonium on the face of the Earth. We don't see any at all. Neptunium has a half-life of 2.36 million years. So if the Earth were younger than 100 million years, we should still see neptunium in the crust of the Earth. We don't see any at all. Now, these scientists that are meeting in the young Earth community are aware of those challenges. And so what they're saying is, well, who's to say that the radiometric constants are really constant? Yeah, we know that neptunium decays with a half-life of 3,000 or 4,000 years today, but maybe the decay rate was very different 100 years ago or 300 years ago. And likewise with neptunium, they say, well, it's got a decay rate of 2.36 million years, but maybe 300 years ago it had a decay rate of 100 days. And, you know, since nobody was around to make those measurements 3,000 or 4,000 years ago or 300 years ago, this is a possibility. Well, a way to refute that is to make the point, now, wait a minute. Scientists were there 4,000 years ago, 300 years ago, 1 million years ago, 100 years ago. And yes, they weren't here making those kinds of measurements on planet Earth, but astronomy is a science that directly observes the past. When we examine the Crab Nebula, we're measuring the Crab Nebula as it was 7,000 years ago, because that's how long it took the light to reach us. And, you know, Crab Nebula is a supernova. When supernovas explode, they make lots of plutonium and neptunium. So we should be able to look at this thing and see how much of that stuff is left. And does it represent the time when that thing blew up? Yeah, it does. Let's look at stars that are not the results of supernova eruptions and see if we can see neptunium or plutonium there. The answer is all the stars we look at in our galaxy do not show any neptunium or plutonium. And so, in that sense, we can measure the constants, not just today, but back in time. And there's a reason why we call them constant. As we look at them in all the galaxies and stars around us, we see that these radiometric decay constants have exactly the same value that we measure today. Now, the other challenge that comes from these young Earth creationists is to say, who knows how much of this stuff was made in the beginning? And we say, well, yeah, we can figure that out. One thing we can do is go to a supernova that has just erupted and see how much was made. I mean, that's where this stuff comes from, is supernova eruptions. And we can test it with a ground-based experiment, explode a hydrogen bomb and see what happens, and see how much of the stuff you made, or try an atomic bomb and see what goes on. Or you can go to Chicago and make this thing inside an atomic pile and see what you get. And those experiments tell us that, again, these radiometric methods produce this much plutonium and neptunium when the fission or fusion reaction takes place. So the fact that we have these unknowns is not true. They're all known. And therefore, I would say radiometric dating still stands as one of the more significant challenges to a young Earth interpretation of Genesis. Yeah, go ahead.
Posted several amazing stars mentioned up on the overhead earlier.
One
of them was multiple universes.
Mm-hmm.
The other one was,
it
looked like something like
the
number of stars,
the
weight of stars.
Yes.
Can you explain what those
amazing
stars are and
Yeah, you'll hear our responses to all 17 in our TV series, but two of the more frequent ones were the ones he talked about. We look at the universe and we see what looks like a lot of useless stars. I mean, we read the Bible seems to be focusing all of its attention on planet Earth. Jesus Christ died one time, one place for all, Hebrews chapters 9 and 10. And the Bible really doesn't talk about other planets as places where life exists. Doesn't mean that's not possible. You know, I do concede that it's possible that God may have created life on more than one planet. I'm simply saying that if he did it through miracles. It doesn't happen through natural process. The fine-tuning that's necessary would rule out natural process for that happening. But the argument of a number of atheists is to say, well, if we're talking the God of the Bible, to fulfill the purpose we see in Scripture, you only need one star, one planet, one moon, one Jupiter, one Saturn, some comets, some asteroids, some dust and gas, and that's really it. You really don't need the other 100 billion trillion stars we see in the observable universe. And, you know, Carl Sagan preached that line in his movie Contact. And you also see it in Stephen Hawking's books, that if we're talking the God of the Bible, it's all such an incredible waste. And their point is that the God of the Bible doesn't reveal himself as a wasteful being. The Christian God is a God that's conservative with his miracles. You know, and I would agree with both Sagan and Hawking that when I read the Bible, I see a God that doesn't waste miracles. He performs the fewest number of miracles to achieve his purpose. Which is why when atheists say, hey, if God exists, why doesn't he perform a miracle? Well, one answer to that is that's counter to God's character. He doesn't waste miracles. He's not going to perform a miracle just to convince you because he's already done that through other miracles. He doesn't want to have to do it twice. So he's not going to do it that way. But the rebuttal to Sagan and Hawking is that they have overlooked the fact that in order to get life at all, even the most primitive life, it's necessary to fine-tune the mass density of the universe, which translates into these 100 billion trillion stars. If you've got fewer than those 100 billion trillion stars, then fusion operates at such a low level of efficiency that the only elements the universe will ever produce is 100% hydrogen, or virtually all hydrogen, a tiny amount of helium, and nothing else. If you have more than those 100 billion trillion stars, then fusion becomes so efficient that the hydrogen relatively quickly gets converted into elements heavier than iron. Only in a universe of approximately 100 billion trillion stars will we get the carbon, the oxygen, the nitrogen, the phosphorus, the potassium that's necessary for life chemistry. So all that stuff we see in the cosmos is absolutely essential to get one planet Earth. If you've got too many, too few, you don't get Earth. To get Earth, you need just that number. And so in that sense, we're turning the tables on the atheist saying, hey, this is not just evidence against God, it's evidence for a God who must have a very high degree of care and love for humanity. This is a God that had so much concern and care for the human species that he didn't think it too much of a bother to create 100 billion trillion stars and carefully craft and shape them for 15 billion years so at this brief moment of time we could all have a nice place to live. So in that sense, I think we need to say thank you to Carl Sagan and Stephen Hawking for strengthening our argument for the existence of God. The second one is probably the most frequent rebuttal you hear from scientists and engineers today. And that is to say, well, who's to say there's only one universe? Maybe there are many universes. And hey, as I read the Bible, there's nothing in the Bible that would convince me that God only made one. He might have made 100 universes and only told us about one. He might have made a billion. Well, what the non-theists suggest is that there's an infinite number of universes. And these infinite number of universes really can't be traced to any kind of cause that we can identify. And so they kind of leave the question of God up in the air. But they say with an infinite number of universes, and if you make the assumption, this is an important and if you make the assumption that all the universes are different, you've got an infinite number of universes where each one has characteristics different from all the others. And on that basis, they'd say statistically, we can explain the anthropic principle. The reason we see all this fine-tuning is, well, you've got an infinite number of universes, all with different characteristics, and our universe is the lucky one that had exactly the right characteristics for light to be possible on a planet we call Earth. So we're the product of a lucky chance rather than a divine creator. Now, I've got this explained in The Creator and the Cosmos, that this is simply a sophisticated form of the gambler's fallacy. And, you know, anyone applying this kind of reasoning at Las Vegas will go broke in a hurry. And a good way to expose the fallacy would be to flip a coin. I could take a coin out of my pocket and flip it in front of you 10,000 consecutive times. And it comes up heads all 10,000 times. Now, if you're not committing the gambler's fallacy, you would draw the conclusion that the coin has been purposed to come up heads every single time. Now, before you'd be willing to bet that it's going to be tails on the next flip, you're going to say, I want to see that coin. 10,000 consecutive heads? I don't think so. Somebody purposed that it's always going to come up heads. You either weighted that thing or you got heads on both sides. And no way you're going to get me to bet tails on the next flip. However, if you're committing the gambler's fallacy, you would say, well, just because it had 10,000 consecutive heads doesn't mean it's been fixed. Possibly outside of this room might be 2 to the 10,000 coins. That's 2 times 2 times 2, 10,000 times. And there may be 2 to the 10,000 people flipping those 2 to the 10,000 coins 10,000 consecutive times each. And if all those other people are getting results different from what I see here in this auditorium, then what I'm seeing is a statistical fluke. Give me 2-to-1 odds, I'm going to bet tails. Now, the reason we call it the gambler's fallacy, the person reasoning along those lines has no evidence for the existence of those extra coins, has no evidence that 2 to the 10,000 people are flipping those 2 to the 10,000 coins 10,000 consecutive times each, and especially has no evidence that they're producing different results. And so when the sample size is 1, the only rational conclusion to draw is that the coin has been purposed to come up heads. And if you're a wise gambler, you would avoid betting tails on that coin. Now, in the case of the universe, we have a stronger rebuttal. Now, we all know there are coins outside of this auditorium. We've seen them. In the case of the universe, no astronomer has ever seen another universe. And it's actually stronger than that. We have a rigorous proof that it'll be impossible for an astronomer to see another universe, even if another one exists. Now, from the theory of general relativity, we have the following conclusion. If God made two universes, and now we have observers in universe A, once you've got observers in a universe, the space-time manifold or envelope of that universe will never be able to overlap the space-time envelope of any other possibly existing universe, which means the observers here will never be able to detect the possibility of another universe, even if that universe exists. So, in a case of the human species, the sample size of universes is 1 and will always be 1, no matter how much we learn about the universe. It is 1 and will be 1 for all of eternity until God takes us away from this universe. So in that sense, all appeals to an infinite number of universes are automatically the gambler's fallacy. Okay, let me hit you with another discovery until somebody comes up here to the microphone. And this one has to do with environmental warming. You know, a lot of people worried about the global warming. And by the way, a year ago, it was fair to say that global warming is something that's uncertain. That's no longer the case. We now know that human activity is significantly warming the planet. The reason why it was a guess a year ago is that the models were not taking into account human effects at global cooling. The truth is, a lot of what we do in way of human activity cools the planet. A lot of what we do warms the planet. But the bottom line is our warming activities are about twice as great as our cooling activities. So the planet is getting progressively warmer. And you may have seen on the evening news that a huge piece of Antarctica is melting away. There's a big ice sheet there, which is now splitting off from Antarctica and melting. But what this article tries to do is look at it in a broader context, saying, you know, there have been climatic disturbances before in the Earth's history. What are these climatic disturbances doing? What they're talking about is cooling or warming, either one. Well, bottom line, we know is it will bring about the extinction of certain species. But what this paper exposes is that even a very tiny amount of global cooling or global warming will bring about significant species extinction. And the greatest impact will be for what they call the top predators and the top herbivores. What that means is anything that's bigger, has a bigger body size than about 5 centimeters. Okay? So I think all of us here have a body size bigger than 5 centimeters. So, but it also means that the animals we value the most highly are also in that category. So, the insects are going to make it, the bacteria is going to make it, but the big stuff that we really depend rather heavily upon will be at great risk. The other thing that comes out of this paper is that you've got your greatest protection where you have your greatest biodiversity. And this is something that's really not taken into account when people say, well, maybe there's life elsewhere in our galaxy or in another planet. That life is not very survivable, according to this paper, unless that life exists with millions of other species. So having life on planet X, where you only got 2 or 3 species, means that those species of life will be extremely short-lived. What you really need is a planet like Earth that's capable of sustaining 30 million species at the same time, if you want those species to last for a significant period of time. And if you drop the biodiversity, it's not just the number of different species, but the variety of those species. And what this really means is that we're not looking just at a planet with the capacity to support primitive bacteria. We need a planet with the capacity to support 30 million species that are extremely diverse. And this is something we're going to be building into the third edition of The Crater in the Cosmos, is a calculation of the probability for a life support planet that's broken down into 9 categories. And one would be primitive life that's unicellular that doesn't have to last a long time. And by long time, I mean more than 1 minute. Okay? The probability of finding a planet that can support primitive bacterial life that only has to last 1 minute, that probability is a lot more generous than the probability of finding advanced, intelligent, large body life that's able to hang around for a few thousand years. That possibility is going to be much tinier than the possibility of finding a planet that can sustain primitive life. And by the way, it's primitive life, small body size, low metabolism that doesn't have to survive for very long. You get a pretty good probability for that. But it's counterbalanced by this. If you're talking about life that's got low metabolism, doesn't have to survive very long, and is of low small body size, existing in a relatively extreme environment, the probability of originating that life becomes orders of magnitude greater than trying to originate that same life form on a planet like Earth. So it really doesn't solve the problem. You get more planets with a capacity to support life, but it's counterbalanced by the fact that the probability of life arising under natural conditions is orders of magnitude less. So you're really better off going with a planet just like Earth. You're talking about making this thing happen without God. This massive search to find broader habitable zones, in one sense, is a waste of time. Hey, you're broadening the habitable zone, but you're narrowing the probability for that life getting started in the first place. And hey, we're only talking a few minutes for it surviving. What's the good of that? So, I'll wait for someone else to come to the microphone before I jump into the next one. Yeah, go ahead. Right. They go away. Right.
Or if they're close enough, but say 500 light years away or whatever, then you would see the short.
That's correct, but I wouldn't want to be just 500 light years away. Because then you get other nasty things that may bring about our demise. Yeah, I'm a little bit worried about Betelgeuse. That's only 300 light years away, and it's due to go supernova. And when it does, we may be saying goodbye to the human species here on planet Earth. But the good news is it's not due to go supernova. Well, it could go supernova tomorrow, but it could be as long as 10,000 years from now before it goes. But sometime in the next 10,000 years, we will have the supernova eruption of Betelgeuse. And I'm not saying for sure it's going to bring about the extinction of our species, but we certainly recognize that that's a very distinct possibility. We do know the cockroaches are going to survive. They will make it. But the big stuff, again, that's one of the things this article is bringing out, is the big animals that are most subject to extinction. So you get a supernova eruption, anything as big as us, we're in big trouble. The mosquitoes, the flies, the cockroaches, they do much better than we do. Of course, if you get a supernova within 100 light years, they're in trouble too. Sirius will one day go supernova. Not soon. It's going to be a lot longer than 10,000 years. It'll be millions of years. But when that goes supernova, everything is in serious trouble. That thing's only 8 light years away. Thank you. That means Christ has got to come back relatively soon. I'm looking for the return of Christ before the really next big close by supernova eruption. And, the last open forum for skeptics, I gave you a list of things that could bring about our demise fairly quickly. And another one is the fact that we're rapidly experiencing mutational decay. The average human being accumulates 3 negative mutations per person, per generation. That's an enormous negative mutation accumulation rate for our species. And as I pointed out that day, it's likely to become much worse. Why? Because we men are giving birth to children at a later age. The later you wait as a man to have children, the more negative mutations you pass on. The other factor, which is probably even more significant, is our increased standard of living. Our increased standard of living permits negative mutation accumulation to survive to the next generation and produce even more negative mutations to that species. And incidentally, that's not just an American phenomena. It's worldwide. The standard of living of every nation in the world has gone up very dramatically in the last 30 years. All over the world, men are giving birth at a later age. All over the world, we have... thanks to our increased standard of living, people with large numbers of negative mutations living long enough to have children. So that may get us before the next supernova. In that sense, I would expect the Lord to return before any of those events take place. He will fulfill His purpose. And by the way, I'm an optimist there. What we've seen worldwide is that Jesus made the promise in Matthew that He would return to planet Earth and wrap up human history once the good news of Jesus Christ had gone to all the nations of the world in a significant enough fashion. Well, right now, the number of evangelical Christians worldwide stands at about 14%. At the beginning of this century, it was 2%. That's been a phenomenal increase. And that's taking into account the increase in the world population. That's 14% of the total population of the planet. My guess is if it hits 33%, Jesus Christ is coming back. So that can happen within a few decades. I'm not really worried about Betelgeuse going supernova. I think the Lord's going to come back faster than that. In which case, we get to go to a much better designed situation. You know, that's something I'm writing about in a book right now. When we look at the creation we see in Genesis 1, God calls it good. He calls it very good, but he never calls it perfect. The perfect creation is yet to come. And the perfect creation is something is promised to all of us who put our faith and trust in Jesus Christ. So that's the thing we should look forward to. And hey, if it happens within a few decades instead of, a million years, I'm all for that. Go ahead. Well, let me make a couple of connections. Okay. A couple of different ways. There's this principle within biology. The bigger the organism, the faster it goes extinct. The more complex its biochemistry, the faster it goes extinct. The longer it takes for that organism to have children, the faster it goes extinct. The smaller the population of that species, the faster it goes extinct. And the fact that we're 6 feet tall means that our population can never get very large. Our size means our our species cannot possibly survive long on this planet. Now, if you're talking an ant, yeah, it can do all right. It's got a small enough body size that you can get a big enough population that you can beat the effects of mutational decay. But we're out of luck. So are the whales and so are the horses. Whales are worse off than we are. Although in one sense our culture maybe put us ahead of the whales, because we use culture to expose ourselves to damage that wouldn't take place without that culture. So on that basis, being a highly advanced species with a large body size means that no matter what, even under the most ideal conditions, we will go extinct rapidly. Now, one way we can use that to challenge the non-theists, they're talking about going throughout the universe and finding life, even finding intelligent life. One of the things they're not taking into account, if you're talking intelligent life capable of mounting a civilization and technology, you're talking about a species that can't last very long. And so the Star Trek idea that a species like ours can populate the whole galaxy is pure nonsense, because that species simply lacks the capacity to survive long enough for anything like that to happen. So we do need to take into account, highly advanced species cannot last very long. You say, what do you mean by very long? Well, for something like a horse or a whale or a human being, we're talking less than a million years that species can successfully survive on the planet without going extinct. And that's well borne out by fossil record studies. The bipedal primates that preceded us lasted, each species, on the order of a few tens of thousands of years only. If you look at the horses, it's a few hundreds of thousands of years only. Likewise with the whales. So we're in that category. And that needs to be brought into the debate on the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life. We're not talking a species that can last a billion years. We're talking a species that's going to have great difficulty surviving a few hundred thousand years, maybe even just a few tens of thousands of years. Okay. A positive spin you can put on that is if we're looking at a universe created by God, whose purpose is to conquer evil through these intelligent beings that he places here on planet Earth, we can rest assured that he's going to do it quickly rather than slowly, because he knows biology too. He knows how long we're going to last. And so I think he sent Christ at just the right time in order to bring about this relatively rapid conquest of evil on our planet, so that the job can get done before we blow ourselves into extinction, or before we suffer the ravages of mutational decay, or before one of these supernovae erupt. God knows the future, and he's got things planned out to make sure that we, his servants, can get the job done in the amount of time we have left. And another way to put a positive spin on it is, you know, this isn't our final goal. I mean, God has a much higher goal in mind for us. And hey, all you gotta do is look around us and say, you know, there's plenty of misery. And in the new creation, there'll be no misery at all. We can be delivered from all this misery. And again, one of the distinctions of Christianity relative to every other religion. Every other religion and cult that I've examined has as its promise for humanity the restoration of Eden, the restoration of paradise. What's unique about the Christian message is it promises to humanity deliverance from paradise. But the thing that I struggle as I go around the world are all these people who would be totally satisfied with paradise. That's all they really want. And I can see the rationale behind it. Paradise is a lot more pleasant than what we're being exposed to right now. And so in that sense, yeah, if I got a choice between living in America at the end of the 20th century and living in the Garden of Eden, thank you, I'm going to choose the Garden of Eden. That's a far superior place than what we're in right now. But it's much less than what God has promised us if we're willing to be exposed to a brief period of time to the misery that's around us. I mean, that again is a Christian message. God purposely ejected us from the Garden of Eden, exposed us to the misery of the real world of the laws of physics, and is going to use that to prepare us to receive something far better than anything that would be possible in the Garden of Eden. So that's the good news behind all of this, and I'm glad it's going to happen quickly rather than slowly. And physics forces me to the conclusion it's got to happen quickly rather than slowly. The other thing I think is really exciting, we are able to pass the course of misery in what, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years. It doesn't take 900 years or 1,000 years to learn the lesson that God wants to teach us through this brief exposure to misery. A few decades is all that's necessary. You know, that's one of the things I've seen, just being close to believers in God that are at the point of death. Saying, you know, isn't it wonderful that it all happens so quickly and we get to graduate? And, as a professor, I can understand that. You know, wouldn't it be nice if I could pass one of my tough astrophysics courses with a 30-minute exam instead of an exam that lasts for 2 days? You know, let's get through the misery as quickly as possible. So I'm all for that. But God realizes that it can't be too brief and it can't be too long. That's another evidence I would see of fine-tuning. God has made our exposure in this world to be the ideal length. And you say, why don't we all die at the same time? Because we're all different. Because we're all different, we all get a different allotment of time. Which is why, by the way, I believe that suicide is a sin. God has allotted an appropriate time. He has told us that it's not going to be comfortable. And we are to put up with a discomfort, just like we put up with a discomfort in a college-level exam. I don't know any student has ever enjoyed taking a test. Unless, of course, he has a perspective, gee, I'm doing way better than everybody else. But again, with the Christian life, we're commanded that if you have that kind of attitude in taking the exam of life, you've got a good chance you're not going to pass. That's one of the things God's trying to teach us, is to get past that human prideful perspective. Okay. Kathy, did you have a follow-up, by the way?
Because God promises that he will fulfill all the purposes for which he made us, and
saw that blow up in 2008. It could blow up tomorrow anyway. You've got to be careful with making the connection with
sure.
the space message, because it's thinking then, so why don't you buy it? I think the good part maybe is that it gets you thinking about the bigger questions. But I don't know.
No, that's really good. I mean, you quoted that verse out of Isaiah, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. The other part of that verse is, if there is no God, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. You know, one abuse I've seen even in Christian circles to what you're talking about, Kathy, is, given that God's going to wrap up human history in a few hundred, few thousand years, maybe just a few decades, why should we worry about preserving all these species here on the planet Earth? You know, again, let's just trash the planet because it's not going to make any difference. I'm not going to have to clean it up. It's all going to get taken care of. And we've all had children who've had that attitude, right? Where, you know, hey, someone else is going to clean up the mess. Why bother? But then we need to realize one of the commands God gave to the human species, Genesis chapter 1. Manage the resources of the entire planet for the benefit of all life, and that tells us we're going to be held account to how well we've done that. The thing I worry about are people who say, you know, since I'm flunking the exam of life, I might as well eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow I die. And this is where the analogy with, say, the tough college course breaks down. Because again, as a professor, I've seen that, where students just give up. Saying there's no way I'm going to pass this course, and therefore I'm going to eat, drink, and be merry, for I already know that my failure is guaranteed. Where it's a little bit different on the biblical side is that our failure is never guaranteed. Like the thief on the cross, you could have blown it all your life and at the last minute make your peace with God, and so it's not too late, ever. It's only too late for those people who think it's too late. For them, it's too late. So that's where these analogies break down, is that God is waiting for every one of us to repent, and he's also recognizing we all need to repent. We've all made a mess of this planet. We've all made a mess of our lives, of our families, and yeah, we don't like the fact that we're going to have to clean it all up, but we repent and get things right and realize that's part of the exam, how well we've done in that department, then great. Okay. Boss.
There was a book published several years ago called The End of Science, where it was based on the idea that there's a limit to our understanding of science, but a limit to how much it's understandable.
Mm-hmm.
We're basically there. For example,
right.
You said, you know, we understand relativity, we understand quantum mechanics, we're real close to the applied theory, and he proposed the idea that we're close to that ultimate understanding.
Right. Right.
I always thought it would be real ironic if God allowed us to get to that point.
Yeah, the book came out a few months ago by John Barrow. And British physicist John Barrow's point is, science has reached the end of its journey. We've accomplished everything significant that needs to be accomplished. And so... he's basically saying that people like myself are going to soon find themselves unemployed. There's nothing more to be discovered, and we better find other professions. I take a very different perspective than John Barrow. And let me give you an historical perspective. You should have seen all the books written by physicists in the late 1890s. And basically their theme was, we're moving into the 20th century. But you know what? It's a bad century if you're a physicist, because everything has been discovered. We've nailed down Newtonian mechanics. We have completely fleshed out the theory of electromagnetism. With James Clerk Maxwell, it's all over, guys. We have done everything we can do. There's nothing more to learn. And yet look what happened just a few years after those books were published. Quantum mechanics, relativity, transistors, this huge scientific revolution just blew the lid off all those books, and we look back at those books and say, what a joke. I think the same thing's going to happen with John Barrow's book. Within a few months, we're going to be able to look back on that and say, what a joke. We thought we had it all figured out. We're not even beginning to figure it all out. I'd also say the same thing is true with theologians. You know, in that sense, you'd say we got a stronger case. We have these 66 books of the Bible that have been studied for 2,000 years. Surely we have reached the bottom of the well. We've pulled everything out of those scriptures we can possibly pull. The job is done. It's time to shut down all our seminaries. I see no risk for that because the history of the past 2,000 years of theological research is, even though there is only 900,000 words in the Bible, we have just begun to explore the message in that book from us, from God. That's one of the things that convinces us that it's from God. Unlike other books that have been written by human beings, this book we call a Bible truly is inexhaustible. No matter how much you study it, you're never going to learn everything you can possibly learn that God has for us out of those words. In the case of the record of nature, you've got a stronger case. We know the database is not complete. We don't understand the database we already have, and yet every day the database is growing. One of the things that makes me chuckle about John Barrow is he's an astronomer, and yet in the field of astronomy, the database doubles about every 3 or 4 years, and that hasn't stopped. It's still progressing at that pace, which is why I may need to have a bigger office a few years from now. I'm getting pushed out by all these journals I'm accumulating. And the fact is, it's accelerating. So I think we've barely just begun. Well, will there ever be a limit to our understanding of the universe? Back in 1930, a German mathematician, Kurt Gödel, published what's now known as the incompleteness theorem. And one of the applications is that theorem is that because we human beings are confined to the space-time manifold of the universe, within it rather than being outside of it or transcendent to it, then we will never learn everything there is to know about the universe. Our knowledge will always be limited. We will never have a complete database. Now, you're right. As time goes on, we should get closer and closer to that complete database. But it's like an asymptotic relationship. What I mean by an asymptotic relationship is that what you know about the sum total starts off like this. But as you get closer to the limits of what there is to know, it begins to plateau off like this, but it never really reaches the line. Well, the point is we're still in this phase where it's going up very rapidly. We haven't even seen the accumulation of knowledge begin to tail off in any way. So we're a long ways from that limit, but that limit does exist. But even when you're near that limit, the database will still continuously increase. You'll never learn everything there is to know. So in that sense, I can take comfort in the fact that I will not be unemployed. There will always be something for me to do. And that will be true if my descendants were to persist long enough for the thousandth generation after me. It would be true for them as well. I don't know how John Barrow's book got published. I mean, I can't think of a more absurd notion. But he is a famous astrophysicist. Yes.
You had a comment on that, about saving the planet, and then the comment about saving the planet is, of course, if I get the benefit from our efforts on saving the planet. If I have better soil in the backyard, then I get to enjoy more abundant plants and flowers, and things grow better. And living in Los Angeles is a good example. In fact, the smog is now better than it was a couple of decades ago.
Right.
It means that my lungs don't get better. Really, I don't have
right.
pain.
Right. Yes, totally. And a very Christian concept at that. You know, Christians of all people should be committed to good ecology.
The question was, I know that recently you've given some of the papers on recent DNA evidence that we're not related to hominids. And I'm sitting here, my mind is kind of going slowly, but it's occurring to me, now you're saying that our DNA decays rather rapidly.
Yes, it's another argument for us not being related to the hominids. In fact, I probably should say a little bit about this paper. This is a review paper that was published in Nature on DNA sequences. And it's commenting on the fact that in the last 2 years, we, by we I mean biochemists, have been able to catalog the total DNA sequences of dozens of different species. I mean, you've all heard of the Human Genome Project, and that's an attempt to catalog all the nucleotides in the complete human genome, all of our chromosomes. And it's not finished yet, but we're a good part of the way there. But in the meantime, they have done it for dozens of other species. Now, most of them are bacteria, where it's a little easier. But some of them are things like flatworms, too. So they're moving on up. And eventually we'll have it for human beings. But what this paper is talking about is a challenge to naturalistic evolution that's coming out of these genome sequences. The naturalist has this idea that, we all arise from this first life form that differentiates through mutations and natural selection into all the diverse species we have on the planet today. Now, if that idea were correct, we would demand a very tight correlation between the genomes of these different species and their morphological distinctions. Because in the fossil record analysis of Darwinian evolution, there is this tree of life where you go from this primitive life form and it branches off into all these other life forms with different morphological structures. And the claim is that these morphological structures took place through mutations and natural selection. Mutations, changes in the DNA. All right, let's look at all the DNA that we have in species of life today and see if indeed there's a match between the morphological distinctions and the differences in the DNA. And this paper is pointing out the match isn't there. We only got a few of these DNA sequences, and the match that we expected to find is not showing up. And therefore, we know, for example, as this paper points out, that the gradualist model has got to be wrong. The idea that life gradually evolves through mutations and natural selection to all these distinctions, the standard Darwinian model, we know cannot possibly be correct. Now, in this country, Stephen Gould has been promoting the idea of punctuated equilibria, which is the idea that life doesn't evolve gradually, it remains static. But something unknown happens which causes this static DNA to jump into something radically different. Immediately jump into something radically different, and you get a new species. Incidentally, that's quite compatible with a Christian interpretation of life. We're saying, yes, there are these genetic jumps. God comes in and specially creates a brand new species. He's the one that designs the DNA, and you get this radically different species. Stephen Gould just says something in the natural realm causes the DNA to jump. He doesn't identify what it is, but he says something causes it to jump. Actually, in one place, he does try to identify it. He says, when the environment becomes extreme, then the species declines in population. And that explains why we have no fossil evidence for the jumps, okay? Because the species declines to such a small population, we don't get fossil evidence. And when it's at that very small population level, the extreme environmental stress shoots the mutation rate way up. And there's rationale for that. If you get a radiation event like a supernova, that's going to send the mutation rate up. Ultraviolet radiation, that will send the mutation rate up. Extreme heat or cold will send the mutation rate up. And so with that extremely high mutation, you get the probability for differentiation of the DNA, you get your new species. But it's highly flawed. The probability for a species surviving mutational change depends on the population. If the population is low, the probability becomes zero. So that's just one reply to that. Yeah, I'll tell you how he explains that. He says, the reason we don't see this going on today is that conditions are pleasant. In order to make this happen, you need disasters, really extreme conditions that plummet the populations of all the species way down, and then under those extreme conditions, you get all these mutations happening, and then what happens is all the species now become adapted to the new disastrous condition. And then they begin to multiply, produce a huge population, and now you get fossil evidence. But the problem is he's speculating that you get this speciation in an arena where the probability for it happening is the very lowest. When you've got extreme conditions, the probability of survival becomes extremely low. He's in a lose-lose situation, and Rudy, if you apply Darwinian principles the way they should be applied, the highest probability for mutational advance is going to be when conditions are good. Not when they're bad, but when they're good. Right. Now, here's an experimental way you can put it to the test. Take a number of individuals in a species. Basically, what we're saying is when a species drops down to, say, a few hundred, a few thousand individuals, that's when it's going to rapidly advance through this enhanced mutation. Well, we can run an experiment. Okay, let's take 1,000 mice and expose it to an extreme environmental stress and see if we get a new species of mice coming out of this rapidly. We can do those experiments. Those experiments, in fact, have been done. And what happens? All the mice disappear. The reason he's so famous is that because people like this have demonstrated the gradualist model is wrong. We now know the gradualist model doesn't work. Okay, the assumption is this. We know the gradualist model is wrong. We are utterly convinced there is no God. Therefore, the only possibility is punctuated equilibria. That's why Stephen Gould is so famous. So. Yeah, we're going to have a conference on this in June. It's called Putting Creation to the Test. We're going to show you a creation model and actually show you how you can test it. And Rudy, the reason we're pulling off this conference in June is that we already know the evolutionists do not have a testable model. The fact, and what's really the reason I'm so motivated to do this conference, for decades we Christians have had a testable model, but we've never told anybody we have a testable model. What we need to do is tell the world we've got a testable model, and then immediately puts the pressure on everybody else. If you want to play the game, you better come up with a testable model. If they don't have a testable model, they're not in the game. We're going to do this in at Grace Church of Los Alamitos, Cyprus. You know, the reason we're not doing it here, we wanted a place with more seating. And if this is a church that's got lots of seating and lots of big rooms for breakout sessions. And the pastor of that church is on our board of directors. He insisted on having the conference at his church in June. Yeah, end of June, we'll do it. Yes. Right.
And he's very careful to shy away from saying absolute. He's setting out a great big theory based upon some information that is not extractable necessarily. And on that, he's had a lot of people say, well, I guess it's such a teacher because he doesn't even have a truth.
Well, he does have some truth in the sense he's found a way to get the DNA to change significantly. So in that sense, he does need to be commended. If, you know, the first step in the problem of naturalistic evolution is how do you get the DNA to change? He's found a way to solve that problem. What he hasn't, however, done is found a way to preserve that DNA. He's found a way to change it, but he hasn't got a way to preserve it.
Of course, the way we all know, there's a mutation. The more mutation you have,
we're almost perfect right now. We're like a machine. You got that machine running at 98% efficiency or 95% efficiency, you can put on a blindfold for the rest of the boat to screw this arbitrarily, you probably direct the efficiency. And that's like the mutation that you have. You have a mutation that directs our efficiency. You might improve it. You might turn the boat just right and get an improvement to 99%, which is odds are right there. And the groups are close. So the more we have the ozone layer destroyed and all these environmental factors too, the more we're going to break down the DNA and of course they aren't good but not because you're so perfect now.
Right. And by the way, Skook Gould is on target if we're talking species of life that have body sizes less than 1 centimeter, with populations greater than 1 quadrillion, with generation times less than 3 months. His punctuated equilibria theory works far better than gradualist Darwinian evolution for those kinds of species. So I want to give him some credit. He's got a good theory for those kinds of species. It simply doesn't work, however, for species where the body sizes are bigger than 1 centimeter, where their generation times are more than 3 months, and where their populations are less than 1 quadrillion. And unfortunately, we're in that category. So, sure. Well, there's actually a possibility I might be sharing the platform with him in the next few months, so I do want to maintain that. That's good, because he has made an important contribution. And we can just simply eliminate the presupposition there is no God. I think we could get somewhere. Okay, with that, we need to stop, because we've gone past our time limit. We do this every 3 months, right here in this building, and we do it every 2 months at the University Club in Pasadena. And we have a luncheon every 2 months where we do this same kind of thing. But you have to pay for the lunch. Here it's a free lunch, so free snacks, I guess. No, I shouldn't say lunch. So, but that, let me close this off in prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for this opportunity to spend some time looking at these new evidences. And Lord, help us to gain the appropriate understanding for what you're revealing to us in these last days here on earth. And Lord, I pray too that you would give us a sense of the shortness of our life and even the shortness of our species on this planet. And Lord, may that help us to focus on the highest priority things from your perspective. In Jesus' name, amen.